There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
I'm Helen Farmer, and this is the Thursday Brunch Show, live with you until 2 o'clock this afternoon on Thursday. Weekend's just around the corner. We're hearing some rain reports, guys. If it's raining where you are, do let us know. It was beautiful and sunny earlier, so keep us informed of any weather developments out there. 4001 for on the text line, or you can message us for free on the Dubai Eye message app as well. And we've got two great friends to get Ramadan started. We are joined this afternoon by the founder of Boon Coffee. It's Orit Mohammed. Good afternoon, Orit.
Good afternoon. Ramadan Mubarak, everybody.
Oh, you say it so beautifully. Now, you come from a long line of coffee roasters and farmers and connoisseurs, and you can find your blends all over Dubai. We're going to be talking about Boon Coffee later on yes. in the show. And also, Arv Ahmed is here from Frying Pan Adventures. She set up the famed foodie tours with her sister Frida in 2013 now. Seems like ages ago.
It does.
And it's grown from strength to strength with numerous cuisines and themes from Bir Dubai to the desert and sellout events and even a podcast too. Thanks for joining us.
It's always a pleasure to be here, and Ramadan Mubarak, everyone.
Thank you. Well, do share your Ramadan messages with us this afternoon as well. So you're both fasting. Orit, can you tell us what you were doing last night to prepare and what you've done with your routine over the night and this morning?
I put automatic coffee machine in my house and I was drinking coffee nonstop the whole night.
Really?
I actually did put a machine because, you know, it takes too long to wait for people to do it, for me to do it. So I've decided I'm going to have a proper automatic coffee machine, which I don't usually like the taste, but it will do.
So what did you eat last night and what have you eaten this morning? Is it just been coffee?
No, I didn't eat much for dinner. I ate my lunch. I had Ethiopian food in Jera, so it's heavy, so I let it. I'm not worried about it. It's not food that bothers me. It's never food. It's usually the first couple of days it's coffee and, of course, water, dehydration. So food, I'm okay with being hungry.
So what will you break your fast with tonight at sunset?
Well, dates and coffee, easy. So it will have. I'll have my Americano and dates would be my first, and then soup.
What kind of soup?
I actually do Ethiopian traditional. I think it's traditional towards all of East Africa, maybe in the Indians. It's barley. It's barley with, they make it with barley and lamb, but I since I'm vegetarian, I make it just barley. It's really nice. Nice.
That's
very
lovely.
Nice.
Lovely. And where will you break your fast? Will it be at home or are you going to go out this evening?
First day home because this is the first year kind of all of us are fasting.
Really? So how old are the kids now, Arad?
12, 10 and 8. So I don't know about the 8. He thinks he's fasting. So I think he thinks he's fasting. So we'll see how long he lasts. But probably not the whole day. So maybe half a day for him. But the other two.
And how do you decide with the children in terms of when they feel ready or when you feel like they're ready to fast?
The first, like when they're 8, 9, for me, it's me convincing them that they're not ready. So because I'm worried. More than the whole day fasting, it's that they don't eat properly at night. Because right. when you're an adult, you know what to eat. So it's very hard. So I try to find a medium. Like if I see them not eating well, then I make sure they break their fast because it's not mandatory, obviously. Mm-hmm. So, but they get so excited, especially my 12-year-old. All his classmates are fasting, so he's not going to listen.
Peer pressure.
Somewhat, you see, the reverse peer pressure. When we were in the States, we had the other way, you know, we felt like alone. Here, it's really nice because even the schools close earlier. So
you're starting a little bit later
yes.
now as well.
So it accommodates. It's really nice.
And what about you, Ava? Where do you like to have your iftar? Is it at home or do you like sampling feasts around town?
Well, it depends. Today specifically, I will be in Sharjah because it's the first day of Ramadan and we're doing our recce before we go live
yes,
on Saturday.
Yes, we'll talk about Frying Pan's new tours later.
Through. But typically, my preference is actually to be at home with the family. It's just for me, this is the time to be with my parents, to be with my husband, my in-laws. Just going into a hotel and breaking my fast is never something that, I mean, I might have done that maybe once or twice in the last 4 years, but it's very, very rare.
All right, you look shocked at that revelation.
Yes, I actually enjoy it. I do.
Someone else cooking.
Yes, exactly. I do. I like having people at home and cooking, but you know, after a while, because it becomes very repetitive, the food becomes extremely so by midway, I'm ready to taste somebody else's cooking.
But I guess if you've got more control at home in terms of when food's coming out, and must be a bit easier in that sense, especially with kids. But I can understand wanting to go out and feel a bit treated. Well, do you feel not obliged, but do you find yourself kind of leaning towards the more Arabic dishes for iftar, or you can really kind of dip in and out of any cuisine?
I'm fine with any cuisine. I prefer soup. I think, I don't know, it's just tradition that you start with soup, so some kind of soup, so whatever it is available, it's fine. Because our cooking is similar to Arabic cooking, or to, you know, it would be nice when you go out, it's not necessarily this similar cooking.
So you're Ethiopian. What kind of dishes did you have growing up that you still kind of recreate here in Dubai?
I'm Harari. I'm from the eastern part of Ethiopia. So our cuisine is a little different. It's a lot of mix of a little bit of Indian, Arabic, and Ethiopian cuisine. So we do all of them. And so we do the samosas, but we do sambusas. It's both lentil and meat. I make mine lentil. Really nice, really nice. And the bhajias, very similar to bhajias from India. But it's just, we change it a little bit when you taste the Asians or the Arabic ones, a little different. And then we do our main course is very different, which is kind of nice, injera, which it's really nice, and it's heavy and it can carry you. It usually is really nice to eat injera, but it's too heavy for suhoor, and it's too hard to make us for suhoor. The suhoor that's, I'm too tired to do. The best I will do for suhoor is just coffee. Nothing else.
So what about your sleeping patterns during Ramadan, Ava? How do you kind of spend your days normally?
Mine sort of flips because my work is so much around food, writing about food, researching food, that I sort of become a little bit useless during the day. And I find that it's easier for me to do physical, like manual labor, picking up things or cooking something, walking around, than it is to actually sit and concentrate. Like doing anything that requires concentration, I'm going to be a no-go. So typically anything that requires focus and concentration, that gets moved to the night. So I'm not sleeping much during the night. I'm a great power napper. So if I can power nap during the day at times, I'll do that, or I'll just wake up later. But I do sort of have to flip my schedule, especially because so much of my work is just around food.
How can non-Muslims and the kind of the general community help people who are fasting? What's useful to you? As you're saying, kind of maybe shifting around work so you are doing things that don't require so much focus, or on a practical basis, how can I help you today, guys? I'll be kind to you, of course, on the microphone.
Not drinking water in front of us. No, I'm just kidding.
Oh, don't say that.
No. Actually, it really isn't. It's about a test to yourself. So I don't. Because, you know, I did live a long time, even in Ethiopia, where the country is actually a bit of majority is Christians. So it's weird. We grew up around, like, my sister's children who are the same age are going to school regularly and still fasting and having exams. So it's part of normal. It's, you know, this is it. This is the test. So I don't feel any. It would be nice if you're nice all the time, not necessarily just during Ramadan.
I am nice all the time.
You are.
But everybody, you mean.
Yes, everybody. I don't think there is anything in particular that anybody else, regardless who it is doing, that would affect my fasting, you know.
So it's a real personal.
It really is. It really is.
And what does Ramadan mean to you on the spiritual side?
It really is. It's a time of reflection, you know. It really is, because you create so much memories during Ramadan. So you always seem like you go back and think about last Ramadan. So-and-so was here. It's you know, it's almost like a celebration. So you remember it. But so you realize, how can I change? How? Hopefully it will carry you throughout Ramadan, through the whole year. But it's a good start. You feel like it's a blank start. Now I can start doing the proper way.
And set intentions.
Yes, the intention is there.
What about you, Ava?
I agree with Orit. I think a lot of it is about communality. So this is a time when I feel, like I mentioned earlier, I feel like being with the family more than any other time of the year. Even when I was in the US, Ramadan just felt really hollow for me, because having suhoor alone, or breaking your fast alone, or in the middle of a meeting when everyone else is just doing their thing, it really doesn't have the soul. So for me, it's a lot about it is coming together of the family, of the community, generosity. A lot of the mosques around Old Dubai, around Sharjah, are giving out food. I love seeing that you know, the community is so engaged in sharing and caring for everyone else. So it's a lot about that.
When we come back, the latest food news. This is Dubai Today. We're joined by two fantastic foodie friends for our Thursday brunch show this afternoon. Arit is here from Boon Coffee and Arva, co-founder of the Frying Pan Adventures. Good afternoon, ladies. We've turned the lights down in the studio this afternoon. It feels like we're in some kind of like lounge, isn't it? It's lovely. I like it. It's just, it's very everything nice. Feels a bit more relaxing. It's because of the lighting.
Yes.
Now tell us, what are your plans for the weekend? Have you just anything you want to discover? Anywhere you're going to try? Any plans for cooking anything special or it?
This weekend, you know, to start off Ramadan correctly. So we'll have a lot of family and friends coming over. And, you know, the time between Maghrib and Isha is short. We eat then and everybody usually leaves to go pray. So, you know, Ramadan is a very compacted time mm-hmm. for eating. And then all of us go to our Taraweeh Salat. So on the weekend, we could do that because the kids don't have school. Weekdays, it's very hard with school being open that to go out and do the proper prayers at the masjid. So this weekend will be the first one we do at home.
And on, you've got some exciting plans with Lime Tree as well,
yes.
I understand, coming up.
Yes, so Lime Tree is on Saturdays. They have a woman co-op where a lot of the ladies who have small businesses in Dubai that bring in their stuff. So we have Carla from Cheese. She brings
Love
in her
Carla's
cheese. Yes, she's sweet. And Elena from the farm.
Greenheart.
Yes.
Greenheart
organic.
Yes, she's good. So she has a stand. And of course, the ladies from Lime Tree will be there. And we have a pop-in. Pop-up. Yes, it's pop-up.
You can pop in for a pop-up.
Yes.
Yeah.
So come and see us from 9 to 2 and, you know.
And is that at the Sheikh Zayed Road brunch?
The Sheikh Zayed Road Lime Tree.
Lovely.
Saturday.
A women's co-op. That sounds great.
Yes, we have a lot of fun. It's
get
really
the,
nice.
Get the gossip, pick up some bits.
Yes, and there's a lot of special treats Lime Tree does for this event itself.
Yeah, they do. And they always have beautiful biscuits and hampers and things which make really lovely Ramadan gifts if you
yes.
are going to someone's house for iftar. What about you, Ava? What's on the agenda?
So Friday will be the first day that I'll get to spend with my family for iftar, which will be nice because today I won't be there. And then Saturday again, we'll be out on the roads. Both Farida and I will be in different parts of town. She'll be doing our Dubai iftar walk. I'll be doing Sharjah iftar walk. So kind of our weekends are also working weekends, but it's all part of the fun.
How much time do you think you spend on the phone to your sister? Or do you have like walkie-talkies? A special sister
I know,
line.
We should just have a direct line. I'm sure there's something we should figure out. Thanks to WhatsApp, there's a lot of voice notes as well. So
do you like voice notes?
I just think it's so much more efficient. You
it
kind
is.
Of clip everything into like a smaller soundbite and that's all the person needs to hear at whatever time is convenient for them.
It's funny because people either seem to love them or hate them. I like sending them, but I don't like getting them.
Exactly. I would prefer people don't send me voice notes, but yes, I would like the luxury of that convenience.
I agree.
But you know, when you receive WhatsApp text or notes, anything, it's hard. Sometimes you're driving or sometimes you're busy and people know you received it. You feel like you're under pressure to answer it. You have a certain time. It's really hard, you know. This WhatsApp has connected us too much.
I quite like WhatsApp on the laptop. Have you tried web WhatsApp?
Yes, that
no.
actually is a game changer.
Funny, my husband's always like, I can tell you're on your computer because my WhatsApps are about three times longer. So I'm just like typing happily rather than the one finger on my phone. It's brilliant, Arit, honestly.
Oh.
And you can share documents and pull them straight onto your computer.
Just WhatsApp for web.
Yeah,
really?
WhatsApp for web. Just saying, it's a bit of a game changer. Should we get back on topic? How about some of this?
The latest food news.
Now, I don't like to talk about Kim Kardashian very much, but we shall because she's in the headlines because she's let herself down, to be honest. She really has. So she shocked fans yesterday with an appetite-suppressing lollipop advert. I know. Ava, your face. You should be on television with that face. Absolutely outraged. So she's angered fans and been accused of promoting disordered eating by advertising an appetite suppressant on Instagram. She's got 111 million followers.
Wow.
She posted a photo of her sucking a flat tummy lollipop, which promises to curb food cravings. In a promotional caption, she described the product as literally unreal, you know, you can imagine, and offered a discount code. And there was immediate backlash, and she deleted the post yesterday as a result. And I think it actually speaks to an interesting point that, you know, many of us use social media, but many of us are maybe speaking to friends and families, you know, maybe just kind of shouting into the void a little bit. But she has such loyal followers who do act on her every recommendation. So I'm very pleased that she's taken this down and taken. And I think actually Instagram got involved in terms of advertising standards as well, because weight loss and appetite suppressants aren't necessarily legally safe. They're not covered by FDA approvals. So the regulators have warned that just because you see a supplement product on a store shelf or indeed on an Instagram page does not mean it is safe. She, in the past, has plugged some pretty dubious diet products. Kylie Jenner's also plugged detox teas, claiming in one post that the teas are good for your tummy area. And Sarah Palin has even got involved.
Oh, dear God.
Yep. The former vice president nominee and Alaska governor shared a photo of skinny tea along with a 15% discount code to her 25,000 Instagram followers. At least Kim Kardashian did do hashtag ad to say that it was a paid for post, but Palin did not. What do we think, guys? Pretty irresponsible, or her platform to do what she wants with?
I think it's appalling, totally irresponsible. But it's what is really reassuring is that there was a backlash.
Exactly. Huge
that
backlash.
To me is reassuring, because that means that people are, they recognize what is true and what is false and what's ridiculous, and they're willing to take a stand for it, and people aren't just sort of gung-ho. Because you see a lot of stuff on Instagram where people are just kind of pandering to the common trend.
Mm-hmm.
So I would have been very disappointed if people just liked that and said, amazing, like, I can't wait to buy this. I'm going over now.
I'm sure some people are like,
I'm sure
they
were. But the fact that there was such a backlash that she had to take that down, that Instagram acted on it, that at least gives me a little bit of reassurance about social media today.
I think people are becoming a lot more sophisticated consumers of social media. And the fact she did put hashtag ad on is, you know, I suppose a good thing. But most people would know that that was an advert, I hope. But I think it was done in especially poor taste because it is Mental Health Awareness Week at the moment.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, it's not good timing. But I think a really positive thing is that it's in the news that she's taken it down and that Instagram has got involved to talk about those advertising standards, because it's something that we need to be protecting people from, whether they are suffering from mental health issues or are young enough to not really know the difference between healthy and unhealthy, right and wrong. So Kim K... Tut, tut, tut.
The question is that discount code still valid?
Naughty. Now, how familiar are you ladies with the old Yorkshire pudding? The English Yorkshire pudding?
Very familiar.
Very, very familiar.
Not familiar at all.
Ava, what makes you so
kind
familiar?
Kind of like a buffed up injera, but not made with teff grain.
Does that sound delicious?
No.
It's delicious. There's been a massive, let's just say an international conversation between Brits and Americans. So not so long ago, Brits got irate after Americans thought they discovered the chip butty, so a French fry sandwich. And there's been a whole kind of sausage roll debacle as well. And now the Americans are trying to tell everyone how to eat a Yorkshire pudding. So the New York Times posted a photo of what they call a Dutch baby, which looks like a puffed up pancake, telling people to eat it with jam, only to get replies things like, you've put icing sugar on your Yorkshire, mate, you must have run out of gravy, and saying the Yorkshire pudding recipe is older than America. Will we ever be able to get on? Probably not. Stay with us. We're going to be having some...
The latest food news.
Loads of foodie headlines, and this one's actually more drink-related. All right, this caught my eye because of you.
Yay.
I'm not sure I like the headline, though. The headline is, coffee drinkers are being conned by suppliers fraudulently using inferior beans in Arabica products. So I need you to explain to me, who, as you know, does not drink a lot of coffee, and to anyone out there who's not very well educated on beans and the processes. The story is, people are basically being provided inferior beans with Robusta beans on products that are being labelled as 100% Arabica. What is the difference?
Well, you know, the taste is actually the main difference between Robusta coffee and Arabica coffee. It is considered, there are some specialty Robustas that are coming up, very rare, but there are some. But usually the Arabica beans is considered more higher, superior to the Robusta.
And why is that?
I don't even think Robusta beans were classified as coffee until the 1900s, late 1900s.
Really?
Yes, until the wars, the world wars. Before then, it was only the Arabica beans. It has, Robusta has a bitter taste, but it has a higher caffeine content. That's why some people prefer the higher.
Not so bothered about how it tastes, but it gets the job done.
Yes, and you know, Robusta trees actually yield more than two to three times a year versus the Arabica beans, which yields one. The taste is the major part. For me, the taste and the aroma, if you have Robusta beans, you could clearly smell the coffee, the difference. Sometimes, you know, you smell a coffee and you're like, it's a weird smell. And then when you have really good coffee, the smell is just fantastic. Of course. Yes, I would say that.
So what do you use in Boone coffee then?
So lucky for me, Ethiopia only produces Arabica beans. Since it's the home of the Arabica beans, you know, we have the genetically over 5,000 types of coffee in Ethiopia alone.
5,000 types.
Yes, those are the ones that have been classified, and there are more coming up all the time. So like for coffee, Ethiopia is the mother country. Of course, I'm not forgetting my Yemeni friends. Since Riyadh is not here today, the Yemenis did actually introduce coffee to the world, as Ethiopians were just growing it for local consumptions and using it locally.
Tell me about your family background then, because as I said earlier, it's been generations of coffee.
Yeah, so anybody...
How far back?
Well, you know, as far as I guess coffee goes back, because the economy of Harar was mainly through the export of coffee, and it was the first region that exported coffee out of Ethiopia to Yemen, because it's so close to the Yemeni part of the world. So this is how it has... So anybody who's a Harari somehow is linked to coffee and coffee farming. That's what we did. That was
everybody. It's just local industry.
Exactly. That was that. And so we were trying to, we were growing it, sending it to Yemen and exporting it out. So it's actually the first place coffee was traded for commercial purposes.
Wow.
Yes.
So growing up, you were surrounded.
Well, that's all of Ethiopia. All of Ethiopia is surrounded. Somehow you are... growing up, you are around coffee all the time, because we Ethiopians buy raw coffee, green coffee. We roast them at home, we grind them. So daily, the lady of the house, a mother, a sister, somebody is from morning 2 to 3 times a day is roasting and grinding. So there's no such thing as powder coffee. Things are changing now that people are living in bigger cities and we don't have the space or the time. People don't have time anymore. But still, even to this day, when you go to somebody's house, people roast, grind, and make you a fresh pot of coffee.
And when do the children start drinking coffee, all right?
Well, you know, this is the controversy. Actually, because we brew the same ground 3 times. So the first one is called Abol, and the last one is Barakat. So that one is the Barakat. You know, it's a blessing. It's just very weak. So usually when kids, you know, become like a young teen, you know, 10, 11, 12, they could take with the last glass. But it's still, it's not a big thing. It's not like a lot of the kids don't drink a coffee. We don't have enough for us. We like our coffee too much.
Sorry, kids. Gonna have to wait. How old were you when you first started drinking coffee?
So I think I was about 12, 13. I probably was sneaking the last bit of the sugary parts, because some people put sugar. We add a little bit of sugar.
So it was at the bottom of the glass.
The bottom of my mom's cups prior to that. But it's such a wonderful time, especially in the afternoon or a midday when the ladies get together. Because you have your moms, her friends, our neighbors, and you know, this is where gossip happens. This is everything. This is where they discuss everything. So it was the best time to be. Usually you can sneak in towards the end, but they won't let you. And we have popcorn for the snack of coffee.
Popcorn.
So kids love popcorn. So we used to try. And our duty was to give the cups to the ladies, you know, and remember which cup they used and all that, and have them. My mom's friends like their coffee, or our cousins. It's really nice. It's always the best part of the day, always.
And how old were you when you left Ethiopia?
I actually left when I was very young. I left when I was 10, because Ethiopia was going through a socialist country, kind of civil war. So we left, and then we went back again.
Where did you move to?
Houston, Texas.
Wow, talk about extremes.
It really was. And you know, I didn't speak any English. I didn't know much at all, because internet wasn't internet yet. So I didn't realize the world, you know, how different we were. And then I land in Texas, and you know, the first thing I know is they put me in ESL class, which is English as a second language. And all my classmates only spoke Spanish. So I was the only child who spoke, you know, Ethiopian language. They could, and it was really, a different time. But it was so nice. It was so beautiful. we still had similarities in our cultures, even though they came from the South American wars. It was usually like from El Salvador or, you know, Nicaragua, Mexico. And I'm here from Ethiopia. It was a real, I didn't even know South America existed and they didn't know about me. So it was really nice, but it was really nice.
And what about the coffee? Did you take coffee with you or were you absolutely appalled by what was happening Texan coffee situation?
Exactly, in Texas. But my family still, the ladies roasted coffee. They used to buy coffee, green coffee, and roast them. It's just, you know, they used to go to the farmer's market or to the South American co-ops and buy green coffee. So we nobody buys coffee. So this is it.
And how long are you in Texas for?
I was there for my middle school years, yes, but I still kept my accent. I don't know. Don't ask me how. So Texas, but you know, Texans are, the people were very loving, seriously, mm-hmm. because not a lot of people know about Ethiopia or even, you know, Muslims, Ethiopian Muslims are for sure. And we were kind of rare at that time, like being foreign at that part where I moved, unless you were from South America or Latin America. So it was nice. It was kind of like, you know, you were different. People were trying to understand you and very helpful. So people were much more sincere. I don't know if it would be the same thing if I send my kids now at the same areas, but it was really nice time. It was more innocent.
And then how long have you been in Dubai for now?
Now Dubai is, my youngest son was born here 8 years. So I've been here 9 years. The move to Dubai was a little hard too.
Really? Why was that?
Because I came in as a young wife with two kids and a pregnant with the third child, and you know, I had in 5 years I had three children, so it was kind of a hard time.
That's hard in anyone's life.
Yes, and I didn't know anybody, nobody at all, so no family network, and my husband was very busy working at that time, so this move was hard. Mm-hmm. The move to Texas was kind of very different, you know, unexpected.
And then you obviously started Boone here in Dubai.
Yes.
Did you always think you were going to work in coffee?
No, not at all.
Really?
I studied African development, economic development, thinking I would be working for, you know, one of the NGOs in Ethiopia back home. So I always wanted to go back and do something that is more fulfilling than just straight economics or something. But there was no Africa to develop in Dubai, so we had to have plan B.
It had to be coffee. Yes. And what did your family think about that?
At first, they weren't very supportive, kind of, because they were like, oh, you did the master's. Why don't you work in the field you were supposed to? Because I was like, I'm going to roast coffee. And they're like, we roast coffee every day.
You can come home and do that. No big deal. People are going to pay you to do that? That's
exactly.
Weird.
Exactly. They weren't like, yay. So, but, you know, in time now, they see the success, not only in terms of money, but just getting the awareness of Ethiopia coffee, you know, to discuss this, it has been beautiful.
Tell me about the name. I've always wondered about Boon.
So Boon actually means coffee in my language. In Harari means coffee, and in Amharic is Bunna, which is very similar. So, and then in Arabic it means coffee beans. So
amazing.
So this is your question, Helen. What does it mean in English?
Boon. It's something to do with the boat.
Boat? Yeah. Hello.
The Boon.
No.
Yes.
No.
Or it can be a positive thing.
Yes,
like,
it's a like blessing.
It's a bit of a boon. Oh, what a boon.
Yes, it's prosperous. And in Dutch, it means beans too. So you see, I covered it all.
Tick, tick, tick. Loving
what
your work.
What does it mean in your language?
Boon. In Urdu, I don't think it means anything.
It means positive.
It means positive. We designed a
did
new
you just
word
make that
there.
Up?
I'm pretty sure, yeah.
It is from today.
Yes.
We are talking about coffee this afternoon on the Thursday Brunch Show. We've got another clue coming up for you to win an iftar at the Dusit Thani, Dubai. When we come back, I think we might have a little chat about a certain wedding that's happening this weekend. Stay with us. Now, we've got some headlines to talk about.
The latest food news.
You're both pretty healthy ladies on the, you know, Orit, don't look, I know you drink a lot of coffee, Orit. But you're a vegetarian. What's your favourite vegetable?
Broccoli?
Is it? Do you want some good news?
Yes.
A doctor has revealed that the only vegetable you need to boost your health is indeed broccoli.
No.
Drink all the coffee you want. So this is Dr. Rajan Chatterjee, who's revealed there's only one vegetable that people really need to eat, and that is indeed broccoli or trees, as we call them at home, to try and get my daughter to eat them. Apparently, it boosts people's gut bacteria, helps to support your immune system and improve bowel health. It goes through the small intestine, it helps to balance that immune system. And then the fiber in the broccoli can't be digested, goes along the colon, which is the last part of the bowel where most of the gut bugs reside. And then they start feeding on that fiber and making short chain fatty acids. This is a good thing. It sounds a bit weird, but that is a good thing.
How should we cook the broccoli?
Well, how do you cook it?
Stir fry, yeah, or steam, but it's not very nice.
Steamed, isn't it?
Steamed with a lob of cheese is always good.
Really?
I think the cheese does the opposite of what you just said.
I love it with melted cheese. Yeah.
So I don't know. I think it's up to you, really, as long as you're eating it. So it's part of the cruciferous vegetable family, which includes kale, cauliflower, Brussels sprouts, bok choy, cabbage, collard greens. They're basically nutritional powerhouses.
Oh, so I should stop eating my kale? I only eat them because they're good.
I had kale for lunch and I feel like I can now eat whatever I want tonight. So yeah. No, I think kale's part of the same family. Kale's good, but broccoli is king.
Oh, wow.
So yeah, but it does makes a funny smell when it's being steamed, I find. A bit like cauliflower. But like,
I guess we're going to start seeing broccoli smoothies now.
Oh,
my God.
It's gonna happen. I hope not. I think we've reached peak avocado. Do you think broccoli could be next?
Definitely. With something like that.
No, because it's not invented in Australia and New Zealand.
True. Good point.
Oh.
Just like the flat white. Yeah?
How do you drink your coffee?
Black. I like straight up black, no sugar. Americano. I don't mind Americano. I love pour overs, but sometimes the manual brewing, I feel like it's a little too not hot enough for me. I know I shouldn't say that, but I like a black straight coffee.
Do you, when you go out, do you find it hard to switch off, Orit, if you're ordering coffee?
I don't order coffee unless I know the place. I usually really? Order tea, English breakfast. Safe bet.
So Arva, you mentioned over the weekend you're going to be doing a recce for the upcoming Sharjah tour. What does doing a recce for a frying pan adventure involve?
So usually we do multiple recces, sure. To be able to prep. But with something like a seasonal tour, whether it's a Ramadan tour or Diwali tour, you can't actually do the recce until, like the real recce, until the season begins, because everything changes, timings change, you know, vendors might shut their shops. So I'm going to go today and sort of just be an observer and walk the route so I can make sure that things are open at the time that I expect them to be open. I don't land up with guests and things are still closed. The neighborhood still has a vibe. There are lots of little logistical details that we like to check off before people actually start doing the tour.
So what were you doing before you started Frying Pan Adventures?
So before I started Frying Pan, I was in a very traditional business route. I had got my finance degree, I'd got my master's, and it was all about, I mean, since I was 10, I said I will come home and I will work with my dad, who has a family business since 1985 in Dubai. So that was the goal, because he has two daughters, and I, you know, the usual mentality is that, if you don't have a son, who's going to continue your business?
You're like, hi,
I'm going to be your son. Like, I'm going to be. And so since I was 10, I was fixated on this idea that I will come back and help my father.
What's the nature of the family business?
So he deals with spare parts for big construction equipment, like forklift, like not edible stuff, essentially.
Okay.
And so I went to the US. I studied. I worked as a strategy consultant for a couple of years, flying all over the US. I wanted to bank in enough experience before I came back and worked with Dad. And on the side, this passion for food started. Like, when I left Dubai and went to the US, the dorms made me realize that food does not necessarily always have to be good. I think I was spoiled in Dubai because mom was cooking for me. I took it for granted. And suddenly now this world opened up where I had to learn how to cook. I had to go out and hunt for better food options. And that actually opened up a different side of me that I didn't know existed, but I probably got from both my parents because they love cooking. Mom is a nutritionist. Like, it was bound to happen.
And probably without even realizing it. When we come back, we're going to be learning about what prompted you to take that first step to start Frying Pan Adventures. What it's like working with your sister. I want to get all the family drama there, Arva. And what we can look forward to over the holy month of Ramadan. I'm Helen Farmer, you're listening to Dubai Today. I hope you're having a fantastic time and you've got a great weekend planned. Ramadan Kareem, of course, to you. We've got some great foodie friends in the studio this afternoon. Joining us is the founder of Boon Coffee, Orit Mohammed. She comes from a long line of coffee roasters, coffee farmers and coffee connoisseurs. And you can find her blends in cafes and restaurants across the UAE. And Arva Ahmed is here, Frying Pan Adventures. She set up these famed foodie tours with her sister Farida in 2013, and it has grown and grown to include numerous cuisines and themes and sellout events and even a podcast. Welcome, ladies. Thank you for joining us. Now, we've been hearing about Arva's background, about getting into the family business completely unrelated to the food industry. So you were working with your dad.
I was working with my dad when I moved back in 2010.
And found this passion for food, or rediscovered the passion. And you identified there was something of a gap. What did you think was missing from the Dubai foodie scene?
I was blogging about when I moved back, I finally had time to write about food and articulate my interest in food. And this was back in the prehistoric blogging era of 2010. So I had started writing about food, and I quickly realized that the things that would motivate me the most to write were all of the things that I would personally discover when I was walking down an alley and just, you know, finding this little guy doing something totally unexpected and delicious on the other side. And that it was something from a different culture. So it forced me to go back and learn about that culture and what the different ingredients were that are typically associated with that culture. And I became so obsessed with that whole journey of exploration that I said, it's not enough for me to write about it. Blogging sometimes felt like a monologue. And I really wanted to engage other people who are living here.
Go 3D rather than 2D.
And the idea was just, it was keeping me awake. Like, it was just eating me up, you know. And I reached a point where I had to tell my dad, I think this is what I have to do. Like, this is my calling. This is what I have to do. And my father, extremely supportive. He's a man who followed his own passion, his own gut. And he said, go ahead, do it. So I actually just quit cold turkey the next year. And I said, this is what I'm going to do.
And what was the first step in setting up the very first Frying Pan Adventure Tour?
There were many, many steps. It took a year for us to get started, because when I began, I was really naive. I said, you know, what's it going to take a bunch of people to the restaurants I love? But it turned out to be this whole legal rigmarole of getting your tour guide license and a tour guide company. So there were many, many steps. But I think one of the most critical steps was having friends, fellow bloggers come and be guinea pigs for some of my earlier experiences. And I quickly realized that this cannot just be about the food. There has to be a lot of storytelling to fill in the gaps and to break the ice. And for that, there is so much food history and food literature that I never knew existed. And just dipping into that opened up my eyes to a whole other world. So for me, learning about, reading about a different food culture is sometimes even more exciting than the actual dish itself.
So what was on that first tour? What was the theme of that one?
The first one was a Middle Eastern one. And it's similar, but not definitely. It has its differences from the Middle Eastern one we do today. So we basically walked around the Rigga Murakkabad neighborhood, trying Palestinian food, trying Egyptian food. Some of the restaurants we did, Iranian food, some of the restaurants we did on that tour are not even featured today.
Really?
And the entire script, the entire thing has completely changed. But I think I'm really happy that I got those initial experiences, because it really showed me what I needed to keep and what I needed to lose.
It's a massive learning curve to have something, an idea on your head or thoughts and words on a page, and then to be standing in front of people delivering them and seeing what resonates and what doesn't, what food people enjoy and what they don't, and also on a logistical basis, how to choose the restaurants which are going to work well on the tour. How did you first approach the restaurateurs or the owners of the cafes?
We had two different approaches. With the Little India neighborhood, the Indian restaurateurs of the small places are often actually available at the restaurants. They're there. They sort of understand this kind of concept. So it was easy for us to approach them and say, look, this is what we're doing. Indian food also can come out in smaller quantities. That's normal. But on the Middle Eastern side of town, that was going to get tricky because Middle Eastern food, it's always associated with big platters, big feasting portions. You can't do that if you're doing tasting portions. It's also, you're not going to find the owner oftentimes, who you're going to explain your concept to. So I said, you know what, we're just going to wing it. We're just going to have to go and do our thing. And over time, somebody's going to figure out what we're doing.
And let us in.
Yeah, and we have to go to these restaurants as often as possible so that they become part of our extended family. And that's what it is. We don't have any written agreements with any of these restaurants, but they are for us like our extended family.
So for people who haven't been on a tour yet, what can they expect? Let's use the Middle Eastern as an example.
Sure. So our experiences are about 4 hours and I would say 20, 25 minutes, give or take. And we feature a number of different foods. So, for example, you would meet the guide and we'd walk to our favorite Palestinian restaurant, which makes arguably the best falafels in not just
That's
Dubai.
That's a massive claim.
I once had this message come on Facebook saying, I'm really upset. And I thought, oh my God, now I have an upset customer. What happened? And she said, I went back home to, I forget which country, and now I miss those falafels and I can't make them again. Can you send me a recipe? And you know what? I can send a recipe, but I really feel like they leave out a secret ingredient. They're not going to tell me. They are the most moist, not oily. They just kind of collapse in your mouth and they're so delicious.
Can you tell us what it's called?
The name of the restaurant? Yeah. Absolutely never, ever.
What?
Guard it with my life. Guard it with my life. I'm so, afraid that it'll be overrun. They not only do regular falafel, like falafel adi, but they do falafel mahshi, which is stuffed falafels. And they stuff them with chili paste and with onions and with sumac. And then they cross them over with sesame seeds. They're delicious. So we take them, we smash them into these massive monster mushakkal, mixed up falafel sandwiches, where we add everything, like the hummus, the ful, all of it, even stuff that you shouldn't mix. We're like, let's go crazy. And these people are just going to make, it's very DIY, like messy. You make your own sandwich, it's going to burst, it's fine, you've been appropriately ambitious. So we do that. We have Palestinian musakhan, which is the Palestinian chicken pie with caramelized onion, sumac. And then we make kunafe from scratch.
How long does that take?
Yeah, so it doesn't take time. It takes no more than, I would say, 10 minutes. Making kunafe is not a long process. And it just takes about 10 minutes. But when you eat it fresh, like I mean fresh from the pan, where will you eat kunafe straight out of the pan when it's on still like just off the flames? The flavor of that is completely different.
Here's my issue. I think I would just go a bit crazy in the first cafe.
Exactly. That's what happens to everybody.
Is it? And then how many other places is on the tour?
What we do is we give people percentage rules. We say that we will serve you as much as you can eat, but you should fill your tummy to 20% with the sandwich.
Okay.
And so you know there's 80% of food still to come. Right? So after that first restaurant, you're only filled up to 45%. Then we go to my childhood baklava shop. We do a gahwa ceremony, which is the Arabic coffee ceremony. We're also tasting a couple of other sweets over there. We go to our neighborhood Egyptian pizzeria, where they toss us this beautiful flaky fitir, which has cheese, basterma, which is cured beef, sometimes eggs and vegetables. It's really nice, flaky, layered, cheesy, delicious. And you dip it in a spicy sauce if you can handle spicy. We have Emirati food after that. That's our main course.
I feel like I should be up to about 170% at least.
Exactly. I never said the percentages are out of 100. And we sit down, we have an Emirati meal with the lentil soup, all of that. And then we go to my favorite neighborhood Iranian store. And that's where we finish out with dessert. But it's just such a beautiful display of nuts and saffron. So we kind of have this little Alibaba's cave of ingredients happening there.
And that's over about 4 hours. And how many people would typically be on a tour?
We max out on a regular public tour at 12 people. We like to keep it as intimate as possible.
And people are walking between the two?
Exactly. And we have little audio systems so they can hear us. It's a very tiny little device which they can hook their earphones into, or we'll give them earphones and they can hear our commentary all throughout. We try to keep it really interactive and informal throughout the experience.
So what's been the biggest challenge so far, Ava?
I don't know what the biggest challenge is. I guess it's, we're even to date, we're still learning. Like, people will give us, because we are always asking for feedback. People will tell us, hey, there was so much food. Maybe you should drop that place out. And then the next tour, someone would be like, we love that food. So I think food is so subjective. I remember I used to serve one of my favorite desserts with rose water. And then we had a lot of people from a certain country that I will not name that felt that rose water tasted of soap. And it broke my heart into little crumbly bits. Mm-hmm. And I could never serve that dessert again. I just couldn't. But you have to learn to not take things personally. Food is subjective. And now we actually encourage people, tell us what you like, but also tell us what you don't like, because both those conversations are interesting to have. Everyone's grown up with different flavors, so that's natural.
Yeah, it's useful. What's continuing to motivate you then? Because there's a huge amount of work, literally legwork in terms of walking around and doing the tours, but the administration side, you marketing.
Yeah, it's definitely not the paperwork that motivates me.
No, funny that.
I think that personal connection with the people on the tour, nothing beats that. There might be days, so I'm very introverted actually, and so for me, yeah,
I know the farmer's market.
That sounds crazy. I know that sounds ridiculous. I'm extremely so. For me, before I go on a tour, I need an hour of silence to just gain whatever energy. I can't pick up the phone. I literally can't do anything. And there are some days when I think I don't know how I'm going to be in front of 12 people today and just put myself out there. But when I'm there, suddenly, even if I was feeling sick or even if whatever, it could have been the worst day of my life, everything changes in those 4 hours because you're with food, you're with people who are asking you questions. And if you have a group that's engaged, you know right off the bat, you know in the first 5 minutes that this is going to be a star. All our groups are good
fun.
But there are some groups that are just insanely funny. Like some groups get delirious halfway through the eating and then it's just all fun and games.
It must be a real bonding experience for people on the tour as well. When we come back, we're going to be hearing about what's coming up for the Ramadan tour. I want to be hearing more about Sharjah and also finding out just who Fatima is. Stay with us. This is Dubai Today. We are joined by Foodie Friends. Our writers here, founder of Boone Coffee, and also joining us in the studio, we've got Av Ahmed of Frying Pan Adventures. Now, Av, Ramadan is a busy time for you. You're fasting, but also the business of Frying Pan Adventures gets very, very busy indeed. There's a couple of different tours going on for people to join. Can you tell us what we've got to look forward to?
Sure. So we have three different experiences for Ramadan. One is our regular Middle Eastern experience, but tweaked for Ramadan because some of the restaurants now do specials like Kamaruddin, which is the apricot drink or certain kinds of sweets. So we do that. But now we also have two different iftar and cultural walks that we have. One is in Dubai, one is in Sharjah.
Okay, so tell us about the Dubai one first.
The Dubai one is a photo walk that we do along with Gulf Photo Plus. We've
Brilliant.
Always done this over the years, but this year we decided to shake things up and pick a completely different neighborhood than the one that
Ooh,
we've done
so
before.
Where have you done it in the past?
In the past, we've done it in Naif on the Deira side. This is the first time that Unseen Trails with Frying Pan and Gulf Photo Plus will be going into Kubeiba, which is on the Shindagha Bar Dubai side.
And what can people expect? Do they need to have a good camera or could I come along with my iPhone?
iPhone is totally fine. In fact, sometimes we get people who will just come along without anything because they just want to experience stuff. So we've had that as well. Any kind of device or no device even is okay. And essentially the experience combines culture as well as photography. So from a culture standpoint, a lot of it is about explaining to people what the month of Ramadan means. Like a lot of people don't know what Ramadan means. It comes from the words Ramida, which means scorching, which is kind of how your throat feels, you know, as you go through the day. But also explaining the significance of the month of Ramadan. This is when the Quran was revealed. We talk a lot about different kinds of mosque architecture as well, because there's so many different gorgeous mosques in the neighborhood. We talk about the significance of Ramadan in terms of this is the time when, you know, you have increased amount of prayer, spirituality. This is the time to get a deeper connection with God, but also the time for generosity. So there's a lot of people pairing Ramadan, which is one of the pillars of Islam. It's mandatory, along with zakat, which is the mandatory alms that you have to give out. So there's we really get into some of these things. What happens if you're sick and you can't fast? We really kind of break down some of the technicalities of that.
So it's a real conversation. People are asking you questions all the way through.
Absolutely. And along with that, we have different, like, so for example, we'll have a rooftop that we'll go up onto safely, of course. And we'll have a beautiful overarching picture of the entire neighborhood, all of the different mosques where people can practice their photography. Also, photography at the time of sunset is just magical. We are very, and have been over the past few years, very, very respectful of people who are in front of mosques and so on. Our rule is that you can should not photograph someone without their permission. And in the past, we've done something in Naif, which hopefully we'll be able to do again this year, is photos that we've taken of bakers or of tailors or just people in their shops. We've actually got those photos printed out from the guests and we hand them back to those people. And it has made, we've had bakers who frame them up in their shop, people who've sent those photos back to Afghanistan. So it's been a very nice sort of Ramadan Eid gift for them. And they've really, we've forged those relationships. It's not about just photograph and run away. We don't believe in that.
And who takes those tours?
So this year it will be Farida and Tanya from our side, and then along with a professional photo instructor from the Gulf Photo Plus side. So we have both the food and culture expert paired with a photography instructor to guide you through the entire process.
Is it sold out yet?
The first date is already sold out, and from the bookings that I see coming into my inbox, it seems like the other ones are selling out very quickly. So I wouldn't bank on spots being available for
too long.
Okay,
so get onto it now. Exactly. And the website's fryingpanadventures.com.
Yes, fryingpanadventures.com.
Now, Sharjah, tell
us
about
this. This is our first. Well, we've done a tour in Sharjah before, but never one in Ramadan. And we're doing it with my favorite person in the heart of Sharjah. This is being done in collaboration with the heart of Sharjah. It's along with Fatma Al-Shuwehi, who is the head of education of heart of Sharjah. She is born in that neighborhood. There's a Shuehan area there, which is where her family, so she's born in one of the buildings in that neighborhood. Incredibly passionate. She knows every person there and she is full of stories. Like one of the stories is that the muazzin, the person who would give the call to prayer in Ramadan would be so thirsty and he has to give this call to prayer without a loudspeaker back in the day. So how are you going to do it when your throat is completely dry? He would carry a bucket of water with him up the stairs because they would have to project from
their
up on the top.
Yeah.
So he would carry a bucket of water just to be handy so that as soon as he finishes the call to prayer, he can drink and then go in. But it's these little stories that give you so much character. So we are going to spend about half an hour first talking about, again, the significance of Heart of Sharjah as well as the significance of Ramadan. We'll be then going to a neighborhood mosque and appreciating how iftar should be broken in the traditional way. The Prophet just broke his fast with dates and milk and not with, a whole like
line. Feast.
Yeah, it was not with a feast.
So people on the tour will be breaking their fast as well?
Yes, in the similar way. We're not going to have a whole bunch of food, but the same way that people in the community are breaking the fast, we will hold ourselves accountable to that same standard.
And obviously, you expect people on the tour to be respectful and in all ways dress appropriately.
All the ladies have to have scarves. We put that all in our reminder emails as well. Plus, we carry some extras.
I was
going to
say,
are
you always carrying a...
Yeah, but we're very, very particular. So everyone has to be respectfully dressed. You have to have everything covered, whatever. Because we are in a mosque area. Mm-hmm. And it's very generous if mosques invite you in or if the people there are offering. I found people to be so generous, even the people with the least. I once had a gentleman who walked up to me and placed a bottle of milk in my hands before iftar, and he didn't need to do that. Like I would have had food, but it's that mutual giving and that connection with the community that I find incredible. So we're going to be doing iftar and then we'll actually take a tour through Heart of Sharjah, which is one of the most beautiful atmospheric areas, through the souks. We're going to be meeting these bakers who make this fantastic crispy crunchy potato filled bread slathered with ghee. It's absolutely delicious, fresh out of the oven. We're going to have one of the oldest sodas of the region as well. And then
soda as in soda drinks?
Yeah, so there's a story around Namlet. When lemonade first came in the 19 whoever knows when, I guess the cod neck bottle with the little marble stopper, I think, came here in the 1920s. People could not pronounce the word lemonade. The Arabs couldn't pronounce it, so they called it namlet.
Oh, right.
And that's when namlet was born. So we're going to have some namlet. And then we will finish out at one of the oldest cafeterias in the souk with some Emirati food, but also with a little crash course on dates.
Sounds fantastic. So if you would like to get involved in the Frying Pan Adventures Sharjah tour for this Ramadan, head on over to the website. It's well worth having a look at the website in terms of everything that you offer, from Bo Dubai to the desert. Absolutely brilliant to read. Stay with us. This is Dubai Today. Now, something's happening this weekend.
It's a nice day to start again. It's a nice day for a white wedding. It's a nice day to
start again.
Nice day. We were going to play something traditional. But then didn't. It's Billy Idol, White Wedding. It is the big royal wedding this weekend. Prince Harry and Meghan Markle's. I'll bet you look positively excited about this. Orit, not so bothered.
It's a wedding. Always get excited with the, you know, the W word in the room. Of course you
What was
get
your
excited.
Wedding like, Ava?
I think it was much more scaled down compared to Farida's, because I lobbied for 3 years for a small Indian wedding, which is paradox. It just doesn't even work.
Yeah, define small Indian wedding.
It means that you don't have, you know, 8 days of events and you have maybe 4 or 5 days of events. Okay. And then you can pare the guest list down from 1,500 towards 500 or something. I mean,
tiny.
At least you can. Yeah. So that, you know, it upsets a lot of people.
Okay.
But at the end of the day, at least you stay sane by the end.
How many people did your sister Farida have at her wedding?
Definitely it was over 1,000. But I don't even know half the people who came. I just don't know.
And your wedding was about half that?
It was definitely half or even less than half. But dad is just so impartial. I remember the other day I caught him telling someone, Arvo's wedding was nice, but Farida's wedding. I'm like, Dad, there's something you don't say publicly. You just don't say that. Because I didn't allow him to invite so many people that he really wanted.
Well, I think your sister would have had more guests than Prince Harry and Meghan Markle. They're looking at about 600 guests. Probably. All right, what was your wedding like?
It was actually a very small wedding kind of thing.
Kind of.
Yes, it was the first time. I did it in Ethiopia, so it was nice. It was really nice. Very traditional wedding.
What was on the wedding menu?
Oh, similar to Indian weddings, we have several days, so the menu changes each day depending on who you invite, which group of people are coming to the.
Oh, really?
Yes.
That's interesting. So the
no, for sure. English food, no pies.
No pies? We don't often
Yorkshire
have pies. Yorkshire pies.
Yorkshire pies.
I would have quite liked to have a Yorkshire pudding at my wedding, but it's Yorkshire pies. It's made my day. Prince Harry and Meghan Markle are, of course, going down the British route for their menu with classic dishes and seasonal produce. They've got Royal Chef. That's a job, isn't it? Mark Flanagan has revealed that the guests are going to be having sweet and savoury canapés and bowl food that will be eaten standing up. So the guests aren't going to be sitting down for a feast. It's going to be kind of eating out of little bowls. I personally would be really, really underwhelmed by this. You look horrified, Ava.
Is the Queen going to eat out of these little bowls standing up as well?
I don't know.
Standing up? No chair?
It's bizarre, isn't it? So I hope someone can sneak some photos from inside
the venue. I'm sure they will.
So they've said that in terms of ingredients and produce, the weather has been very kind. The timing of the wedding has been great because all the British vegetables are coming into season. There's been lots of talk about what the wedding cake is going to be. Elderflower seems to be the main flavour, and some lemon. And the chef, Mark Flanagan, said they've tasted everything. They've been very involved in every detail. And lots of produce coming from Her Majesty's estates. So, you know, that's quite useful, isn't it? You get some of Granny's ingredients from around the country. So mainly classics, which I think could be quite... But we thought we'd maybe go back in time and talk about what previous royal weddings had have. And also a bit of an excuse to play some music from those eras as well. Let's start with 1981. This is Prince Charles and Princess Diana. In 1981, Prince Charles married Lady Diana Spencer. And on the menu, they had strawberries and cream, brill in lobster sauce, Prince of Wales chicken, that's chicken stuffed with the fine lamb mousse, and a total of 27 cakes, including their official wedding cake, which is an ornate 5-foot-tall fruit cake with white icing. I mean, it's just decadence to the absolute, you know, nth level. They had the wedding of the century, apparently, and there was a stunning 3-tiered chocolate hazelnut wedding cake. But I think we can probably go even further back in time. What about 1947?
Open the door, Richard. Richard, why don't you open that door?
My head is 4 o'clock in the morning and I'm just getting home. Now, that's a drag. I should have been home 11 o'clock. Well, I know. I left my key home. I know that. So I'm going to have to wake up Richard. He's my roommate. You know, he's a real great cat.
The music of 1947 there. So Princess Elizabeth, Queen Elizabeth II now, married Prince Philip, or Philip Mountbatten as he was then. And it was took place in November. And of course, 1947 was a time of real post-war austerity. So the royal chefs were really quite challenged in terms of what ingredients they could get their hands on. But they managed to, you know, pull out a few stops for Liz. And they had fillet of sole, had partridge, and they had a dish called Bombe Glace Princess Elizabeth, which is a nice cream dish made with luxuriously out-of-season strawberries. So I'm very intrigued to hear what's going to go down at the wedding. Obviously, there's been quite a bit of drama in the lead-up to this wedding. Ava, are you going to get the chance to watch it, or are you going to be working?
I am going to be out doing iftar because I can't believe it. We scheduled two tours during the royal wedding, which has been alerted to us by our British media that we've done that faux pas.
You're looking at me there.
So I guess we'll just have to get the replay after.
It's all about the dress, really.
It is.
How many dresses did you have for your wedding then, Ava?
Usually you have your event dresses, which in my case was, I think, three. And then you have the between event dresses, which then you need one for every one of the days that you're serving.
Where are they now?
They're sitting up in a closet somewhere. Some of them, the between event dresses, you can recycle at other people's weddings or whatever else. But yeah.
And what about your husband? Was he getting changed as much as you?
No, they don't even. I mean, with guys, it's so much easier. They can leave their wedding shopping right till the last minute. I was having nerves about whether he would even get it done in time. But no, not half as much. And they can definitely reuse their clothes across different weddings.
All right, what do you wear for a traditional Ethiopian wedding?
Well, you know, my sister who was with me, Aisha, is getting married July 1st in Ethiopia.
Oh,
so she
lovely.
Left us. Yes, she was here 2 years doing my marketing. So now I'm trying to organize the wedding. It's 2 weeks after Ramadan, which is hard because you cannot go shopping while you're hungry at the malls. They just don't seem fun. So it's but a lot of the traditional clothes is already made. So I don't have to worry about that.
And what kind of colors and styles?
We're very colorful. I think fuchsia, orange, these are colors meant for the our part, apparently, mixed together. Color, we love color.
What did you wear on your own wedding day?
We like it all. So we have traditional day of 5-6 days of wearing traditional Harari clothes. And the last day, we wear the white gowns. We want to add.
You go Western.
See? Exactly. So we have a dinner party. So we do it all. We become very colorful the first part. And the last day, all white.
Oh, and what about the men? Do they get into the Western suits?
Yeah. They're there too. I forgot.
Yeah,
yes.
The afterthoughts.
You know, when you discuss weddings, it's all about the bride.
That's
yes.
So do you know, when I was planning my wedding, I was really into Pinterest. And I had a Pinterest board for, you know, like flowers and dresses. And it was called My Wedding. It wasn't even called Our Wedding. My husband was like,
I had to be corrected many times.
Well, like my wedding.
Yeah. Do you have this tradition of passing down dresses? Because we have that for some of, like,
really?
Our main wedding yes. function. Yeah. Like I wore what my sister wore. And it's nice to, and we all have worn what our grandmother wore
yes.
around her neck.
Oh,
like it's
really?
A certain kind of necklace that has to be worn.
Oh, my mum got married in 1977 and it was not a nice dress at all. It would be nice to have some piece of jewellery. It's not a given tradition, yeah. but we obviously have to wear, you know, wear something old, something new, something borrowed yeah. and something blue. So I'm going to a royal wedding party on Saturday afternoon and we have to wear something. I was thinking about wearing my own wedding dress. I haven't worn it in a while. Why should
I? You still fit in it after the babies.
Okay, so now let me tell you. We got legally married and we had a small wedding, and then a year later we had the big wedding and I was pregnant for our big wedding, so I was 7 months pregnant, so I'm totally going to be able to fit into the dress. Not a problem. Plenty of room for elderflower wedding cake. But there are lots of places that are showing the royal wedding across Dubai if you are interested. The QE2, as we know, is now here at Port Rashid and you can go there and watch it. Barasti is having some screenings as well. Firouz is doing their McGettigan's JLT. You can go and see it. Everyone's going a bit wedding crazy. So there's loads and loads of choices. If you want to go a bit sophisticated, the Ritz-Carlton Dubai is having an after afternoon tea in the lobby lounge from 2 o'clock, where you can sample their version of the royal wedding cake with those flavours of lemon and elderflower with buttercream and garnish with fresh flowers. Any dress predictions? What can you see Meg's walking down in, or at?
Really, I didn't think much about this question.
That's because I just thought of it myself this very second. Modern, traditional.
She's a beautiful girl, so, you know, whatever she wears, I think she's going to pull it off well, I guess, I'm assuming.
I hope so. A lot of people watching.
I feel like Kate went very
she did,
traditional. She did, with and the lace. I think this will be a little bit more Americanized.
So what do we think about this bowl eating then? How would that go down if you were to be in a church, you know, watching, you know, the ceremony, and then you go for, you know, what you think is going to be a big dinner, and you're presented with little bowls.
Big is the bowl?
Yeah, those are small. Called appetizers at our weddings.
Yeah. Like
it's not, yeah. So I that's okay if that's an appetizer.
How many bowls do you get?
I know, do you think they'll stop you? I hope not. So they're basically, as a modern couple, the word is they're going for the new casual with standing up and tasting spoons and tiny napkins. This would not go down well with me as a guest at all. So I'm sure it will, of course, be all delicious. But this is me being very practical. If I'm wearing heels, you know, I don't feel like Harry's really thought about this from a woman's point of view. If you're wearing heels, you need to be sitting down. You can slyly take them off under the table and then put them back on again for dancing later on.
Yes.
Harry, Megan should be thinking about this. When we come back, we're going to be hearing our guests' food fantasies. Stay with us. We're joined by foodie friends this afternoon. Av Ahmed is here from Frying Pan Adventures, and Orit, the founder of Boone Coffee, joins us. Thank you, ladies. I know you're both fasting this afternoon, so we really appreciate you being here and spending your time with us on this first day of Ramadan. So tonight, Orit, you're going to be cooking?
Yes, probably after four I'll start cooking because I have a few guests coming in. So I'm looking forward to it. It's exciting.
So you go quite traditional with your Ethiopian, or a bit of a mix?
No. I do mostly Ethiopian because people, when they come to my house, they expect Ethiopian.
You'd be a bit disappointed if they got anything else.
Yes, I think so. And it's nice to. This is the good time to introduce them to our food.
For anyone who's not invited to your house for iftar, where's a good place to go for Ethiopian food in Dubai?
There's a few places that are good. The easy one is on the Palm. Gursha is pretty good. It's very good. And also, Dera has a lot from Habesha to... Habesha has a few outlets. And, of course, Masob is there. And my favorite was... Zagol is good. Zagol is very small. Yeah. And there's a new one called Dankira. So, very nice.
What does that mean, Dankira?
It means celebration. So it's really nice. Most of them are very good. Then they cater usually to the Ethiopian crowd, so they're very authentic. It's nice.
You said that making gestures with your hands to imply large portions.
Yes, and it is large portions. Reasonably priced.
And for anyone who hasn't had Ethiopian food before, what dish should be an absolute must order?
Oh, this is a hard one.
You've got to sell your cuisine on that first bite.
Okay, well, my favorite dish from the restaurants that serve is shuro, which is a chickpea mix with spices, and it's really nice. It's my favorite, and it's actually considered a poor man's meal because it's just chickpea and spices, and you make it a stew. But it's my children's favorite dish and my favorite dish too.
Oh, sounds yummy. Now, you guys are regular guests on the Thursday Brunch Show. We often have a chef in, which means we don't normally get to hear this.
Food fantasy.
Your food fantasies of Ahmed Frying Pan Adventures. You've had time to think about this. What's your food fantasy?
I have read a lot about the Persian Empire and how sophisticated they were even as far back as the 6th century in terms of their food. I would love to be invited to one of those 6th century, like between 6th and 10th century banquets where they would sort of have poetry accompanying their food. So this courtier would come out and say this poem about, let's say, zulabia, which is the fried sugary sweet, and then a tray of these sweets would come out. So I would love all of that pomp associated with the food. Yeah.
So you want to go back in time?
Exactly.
I'm not sure I can help you with that. In terms of reading, do you read fiction that features food, or do you read lots of non-fiction, kind of historical about food?
Non-fiction, mainly non-fiction historical stuff, and then there's a lot of writers now, for example, like Anya Cesaldo, who weave their current day experiences in the Middle East with historical accounts as well. And there are also cookbook authors who not only just provide recipes, but also the historical context. So I'm a recipe, like I'm a cookbook collector, not for the recipes, but actually for the context that goes along with those recipes.
How many books do you think you have?
I have stopped counting.
Have you? Where are they kept?
In different places. I just kind of sneak them away. I realized that we had an empty space in the coffee table that I'd completely forgotten. So I refuse. I haven't. I hope my husband isn't listening because he doesn't know that empty space exists.
Over.
So I've already taken it over.
What about you, Art? Do you follow recipes or is it more things that have been handed down from family?
Yes. No, I was going to have a food fantasy, but since I'm fasting, my mind is blank. We'll come back to this another time.
That is an absolute deal. I'm not going to let you leave. No, I'm joking. You can of course do it another time.
Yes.
So what about cooking at home? Who taught you to cook, Art?
My mom, my sisters. I have five sisters and my mom. We cook all the time.
Five sisters?
Yes. And actually, Ramadan is the time we all cook together. We're all inside the kitchen, literally. So cooking, and it's kind of a competition who makes what, and we become a master by the end of Ramadan of one dish. It's the best time. We laugh. We make an outside kitchen, open kitchen, and we actually invite a lot of people who may not have families around this is in Ethiopia. So my grandfather had a tradition of inviting, having a lot of people who are less fortunate. So we cook for everybody, but it's the best time. The cooking part, I enjoy a lot.
So you have five sisters. Any brothers?
No.
All girls.
Six girls.
Oh, your poor father.
Look, I have three boys. I'm paying for it. You see, pay for it. I have three boys now. And I'm always like, oh my God. My mom did too much, asking for boys. So it came the next generation. All of us, the sisters, have boys.
Really?
Yes.
Wow. No way.
So you see.
So I've got two girls and my husband feels hugely outnumbered. He often looks at our dog, who's a boy, and just like, you and me, mate. Just you and me. And he calls us the cost centres. It's all very, it's very charming, as you can imagine. But isn't that interesting? Five, and then you've all had boys in that next generation.
Yes. So it's we always say you ask for blessing too much, and now it's coming on the next generation, you see. But I can't imagine cooking now for Ramadan with my boys. They're not... The cooking.
Does your 12-year-old drink coffee yet?
No, they keep asking with the new machine I have in the house. They feel so easy to push. Yesterday they were like, can we try? I was like, no, no.
Do you think they would stay in the coffee business?
The world is changing so fast, so much. I have no idea. Who thought I would be living in Dubai? So I have no idea. I'm trying to convince them so they'll be hooked on coffee and stay, but I don't know.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because with that generation, they're doing things at school. They're going to be training for jobs that don't even exist yet.
Exactly.
But people are always going to drink coffee.
I'm sure they will. So I don't know.
What's in terms of Frying Pan Adventures kind of moving forward? What was your kind of ultimate goal when you started, and where do you think it's going to be going?
When we started, it was a very small dream. I don't have like a 5, 10-year, 20-year. I'm very much the kind of person who just takes it step by step. Every year has been different, and this year we finally had a chance to get our head out of the forest and just like really think about what we wanted to do. And we realized that we've not done anything dedicated to the residents. So now our goal for the next couple of months and years is to actually focus on our relationship with the residents. So we're going to be starting a club, for example, which is called Sufra, which means communal dining. And in Arabic, and it's all about taking some of the research that I do when I'm doing food stories for different magazines or when we do the podcast, taking all of our research and converting them into experiences. So whether it's going
fantastic.
To Hatta and, you know, trying the special lamb that's cooked in the underground ovens, or meeting the coffee historian in Alain, or having the oysters in Fujairah, whatever else, like all of these different experiences.
Orit's pointing me like, hello.
And Orit will be our first honorary member.
Okay, thank you.
I asked you off air how you guys met and you said here.
On the show, yeah.
On the show a while back, but we've become very good friends. She's funny.
She's funny.
But you, between the two of you, you know pretty much everyone, right? So you could definitely start some kind of foodie club. That'd be brilliant.
That's exactly the point.
And for anyone who wants to find out more about the tours, where should they go, Ava?
To fryingpanadventures.com.
And you can book through there. All the information you need is on there. And you can pay through that portal as well.
Exactly. It's all pretty seamless.
Super easy. And for anyone wanting to try coffee...
We're still open. I mean, the cafe is closed for Ramadan, but we're still, you can order online or you can call our office and we deliver. Buncoffee.com.
You deliver?
Yes.
Amazing. What's the kind of the most popular flavor at the moment, the most popular blend?
Full and Wild is our number one selling blend, but I myself like premium in Kaffa.
Ah, premium. Just because you're expensive to run, my dad would say. So that's the first thing tonight. Come sunset, coffee, dates. Family,
yes,
soup.
That's it. Then the rest is easy. Whatever comes, we take along.
Well, listen, wishing you both a very blessed holy month of Ramadan. Thank you so much for joining us on this day. We really, really appreciate it. Ava and Orit, thank you so, so much. Goodbye.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.